Good evening and welcome to the New York Society for Ethical Culture. My name is Michael Bogdanfi Cree and I am president of the Board of Trustees of the Society. Thank you. Many of you know something about tonight's distinguished guests, but I expect that ethical culture is a mystery to at least some of you. The New York Society for Ethical Culture was founded over 125 years ago and has been progressive, liberal, and proud of it from the beginning. Among our outstanding achievements are the founding of the Visiting Nurse Service and the Ethical Culture of Fieldston Schools. We joined with others to establish the NAACP, the ACLU, the Legal Aid Society, and the New York Committee to Abolish Capital Punishment. Our members have a long tradition of advocacy on civil liberties and human rights issues. We are humanists. We place our faith in a demonstrated capacity of people to do wonderful things. We believe in the worth and dignity of all living beings and seek to respect and protect it. Our conviction is that we must conduct ourselves and the business of our institutions in such a way that we bring out the best in and for all. As a community, we believe that all people have the right to freedom and dignity. We stand for the separation of church and state. We stand for a woman's right to choose. And we believe that everyone's vote should be counted. Among the commitments that we ethical culturists make to ourselves and the world is to be informed citizens. It is in that spirit that we proudly co-sponsor tonight's event through the donation of our auditorium. I'd like to thank tonight's co-sponsors, the Community Free Democrats and the Sierra Club, for bringing us this essential program. Membership at Ethical Culture is open to all who share our values. I invite you to get to know us better. Please stop by our table in the lobby where you can pick up literature and sign up to receive notification of future events. You can also check us out on the web at NYSEC, that's NYSEC.org. And now, Jason Haber, president of Community Free Democrats, will come out and get your program going. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's my job tonight to welcome everyone here and also to give out some special thank yous. And really, I'm delighted to have this job because, in a way, it's the easiest job of the whole night. I was thinking backstage that they should have had a politician stand up here and do the welcomes because I'm the only person tonight who does not have to stake out a position up here tonight. So this is quite exciting for me. We want to thank the New York Society for Ethical Culture for allowing us to use this magnificent space tonight. And we really thank them so much. Let's give them a round of applause for the space, because it really is terrific. There's no better place to hold this kind of event. Democracy for New York City, the Sierra Club, the New York City Group, and all the other organizations who have joined with us tonight to be here for this really important occasion. And I have to thank a couple of people in CFD. You know, so often the work in functions like this, in events, it looks like it all comes together so easily. But trust me, there were, 3,000 meetings that went into tonight, and people opened up their homes. And I want to thank some people. First, Sally Swisher. Sally, thank you for all your hard work. Where's Gail Ettinger? She's somewhere running around. Gail Ettinger, thank you very much. And where is she? Where's Bernadette Evangelist? Bernadette, big thank you, Bernadette, for all of your hard work. Thank you. Thank you all so much. I also get to talk a little bit about CFD. For those of you who are not members of Community Free Democrats, I think you'll find that we're a very active political club in our community here on the Upper West Side. And we're active on all sorts of issues, whatever it may be. But tonight we're here to talk about voting, and it is so important because so often you hear people say, well, you know, what's the big deal? It's amazing how quickly people forget Florida. It's amazing how people forget that really since the first election in our country's history, George Washington was elected pretty much by unanimous consent, it has never been easy. And as society evolves and as things get more complex, so does voting. And it's important that we keep an eye on this issue. And that's why I'm so glad tonight that we are doing that. And also, I hope that tonight is the beginning of the discussion, not the end of it. I hope that the things you take from here and the things you hear on stage you share with your friends, and that we make this the beginning of a long-term dialogue. So I hope that we all will find something interesting out of this tonight. And finally, I get the privilege of introducing a committee member and a member of DFNYC, Dan Jacoby, who is going to also welcome and talk a little more for tonight. So Dan, come on out.
Thank you. Good evening. It's wonderful to see all of you here tonight. Democracy for New York City, or DFNYC, is an all-volunteer nonprofit political action committee. We work both locally here and also nationally in conjunction with other like-minded groups to support socially progressive and fiscally responsible candidates for office, from everything from school boards on up to Congress and the White House. But that's not enough. After the election, we hold their feet to the fire. We work very hard to support legislation and legislative activities that have a positive effect on communities large and small. A couple of examples I'll give. We're working very hard to support many of the Brennan Center's reforms that they proposed for Albany to try and fix things up there and get rid of three men in a room. Also, we've been working very hard for a long time to do things like this, to bring information to people about the new voting systems we're going to be getting, to make sure that the ones we get are the best possible, to make sure that our elections are fair, honest, and open, so that everybody can be confident that our elected officials really were elected. In addition, we bring politics to ordinary people because that is what democracy is all about. We believe that power comes, or should come, from the bottom up, not from the top down. And that's why we have this grassroots organization. To that end, we have not only a sponsorship of events such as this, but we have our regular monthly meetings known as link-ups all around the city, in which people get involved, they meet each other, they bring in their ideas, your ideas of what you want to do, what you want to change. You bring it to us, you become part of us, you network with other people, and that's how things get done for us. People come in from the bottom, from the outside, become part of a grassroots organization. We work with other organizations, we work within ourselves to help foster new ideas and get this accomplished through the elected officials or through society. Our next link-up, our link-ups are the first Wednesday of every month. They're all around town. And you can find out where these are, find the one nearest you, as well as all our other events on our website, which is www.dfnyc.org. Yeah, that's a tough one. So thank you again for coming, and we're at DFNYC. We're very, very pleased to have you here and very proud to have these wonderful people who are going to come out now and be our panelists. I have one more very happy duty tonight, and that is to introduce our moderator for the evening. Adam Cohen is a native New Yorker, a Manhattanite, but he got off the island very quickly. Graduated from the Bronx High School of Science, went to Harvard College and Harvard Law School. He's a lawyer and author with an interest in legal issues, politics, and technology. His books include authorship of The Perfect Store, Inside eBay, and also a co-author of American Pharaoh, Richard J. Daley, His Battle for Chicago and the Nation. After graduating and writing, where am I here? There we go. He became an education reform lawyer and then became a lawyer for the Southern Poverty Law Center. Then he turned to journalism, became a senior writer for Time magazine, where he wrote about such, things that have nothing to do with us, like the Supreme Court, internet privacy, the Microsoft antitrust case. In 2002, he came over to the New York Times, where he is now, I want to get this right, assistant editor of the New York Times. He assigns and edits, among other things, Talking Points, which is extended editorial essays which can be found on Times Select online. In 2004, he wrote an editorial series for the Times called Making Votes Count, which looks at the mechanics of our various election systems. I am very pleased and very proud that he was able to come and join us tonight. And I'm very happy to say, ladies and gentlemen, our moderator for the evening, Adam Cohen.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here, and it's really exciting to see all of you here because, to my mind, this is one of the most important issues that the country faces, really, is making sure that our democracy, the mechanics of democracy, work properly. And you hear a lot about other important issues like Iraq and the economy and so forth. You hear so little about this issue. So whenever I see people turning out and caring about it and saying that they want to get involved, it makes me very happy. So thank you. Thank you all for coming tonight. And we have a great panel who I'll be introducing as they start to speak. Two of them are on their way, Congressman Nadler and Doug Kellner. And we'll start with the ones who are here. But first, I wanted to say just a few words about the issue. This is obviously a very timely gathering because we're less than 2 weeks away from an election that many people could be really pivotal in the direction our country takes. One thing that isn't mentioned so much about this election is that about 80% of all the votes are going to be cast on electronic voting machines. For those of us who follow the issue, who know about electronic voting, that's a very sobering thought. Now, it's something that I hope will at least tease out some of the problems with tonight and maybe begin to talk about some of the solutions as well. Electronic voting is a interesting story because not that long ago, electronic voting was seen as the answer to a big problem. The problem, of course, was in 2000, after the mess in Florida when everyone saw on TV, you know, the shambles that is our voting system. No, you know, very few of us knew about pregnant chads and hanging chads and how hard it was to actually tell, in many cases, who someone had intended to vote for. After that national electoral debacle, the decision was made to try to change the election system. And the response was a federal law called the Help America to Vote Act. HAVA made a few reforms in the election system, many fewer than a lot of us would have hoped. But one thing it did very aggressively was allocate money to buy new voting machine systems. The problem was that the people who had to buy the machines at the state level didn't know that much about how voting machines worked. And in many cases, when they saw the money was available, suddenly they were descended upon by vendors, companies that were eager to sell machines. And a lot of these vendors did a very good job of selling bad machines very quickly. So we see states like Georgia and Maryland, these are sort of the two poster children in many people's minds for bad decisions about voting machines. They rushed out very quickly, bought all Diebold voting machines on a statewide basis, no paper trails, very few checks of any kind, and they are using them now. And to the regret of a lot of people in those states, there have been a lot of problems. Other states have also moved more quickly than was probably advisable to buy electronic voting machines that now people have a lot of concerns about. New York, fortunately for us, our state government is so dysfunctional that we haven't done a thing at all. So not to worry. We may be using those lever machines well into the end of this century. But anyway, at least we're not stuck with statewide Diebold voting machines. Now, so it started out as a reform, this idea of using electronic voting. But the more we actually heard about how it worked, the more concerns there were. There were always some skeptics out there who, you know, thought that, people from far away were going to be controlling the machines, you know, the sort of tinfoil hat crowd. But it turns out that actually a lot of people who know the most about computers were the most concerned. You may have heard about people like Avi Rubin at Johns Hopkins, who has a new book out on the topic, Ed Felton at Princeton. People who really understand how computers work are among the most concerned about electronic voting machines. So it's actually one of the few areas where the conspiracy theorists are not, you know, the people who know nothing, but the people who really understand what's going on. Now, as these doubts have grown, the public has begun to wake up and demand reform, and that's one of the issues we'll be talking about tonight. And, you know, you don't need to be following it so closely to hear stories that really raise deep concerns. I'll just quickly mention three things that were in the newspapers in the last 6 to 8 weeks that, you know, to my mind are quite alarming. The first is there was in the primary election in Maryland, there was a closely contested congressional primary. And in the end, the challenger came close, didn't win, but then people began to hear about how the voting actually went in Montgomery County. What happened was the person who was responsible for
dropping off the memory cards for the electronic voting machines in 200 polling places in Montgomery County didn't actually get there with the cards. So there was chaos and confusion. And before the election day was over, they ran out of all the paper ballots they had. And I was told by someone who I believe lives in the county and also is an elections expert that literally poll workers were reading the ballot, just reading it out loud, and asking voters to find a scrap of paper, a piece of campaign literature they might have brought in with them, something off the floor, write down their choices and put it in the ballot. And those were literally counted, is my understanding, in that congressional election. Obviously, that's a disaster. Different kind of disaster was also a couple weeks ago. Many of you may have read about Ed Felton, a professor at Princeton, who did a study of he and some students tried to hack a Diebold voting machine, the kind that, you know, a lot of states are now using, and he found it wasn't difficult at all. The key to the lock is one that the same key that's used to open a mini bar in a hotel or, you know, a piece of luggage, and it's all the same key in all the machines. And he found that malicious software running on a single voting machine can steal votes with little, if any, risk of detection. The malicious software can modify all the records, audit logs, and counters kept by the voting machine so that even careful forensic examination of those records will find nothing amiss. Obviously, a big concern. Final thing that is also out there to worry about, a lot of us believe that paper trails, contemporaneous paper records printed out by the machines, the way your ATM gives you a record of the transaction, is the only answer, because that way, everyone has a piece of paper associated with their vote. They're able to look at that paper, make sure it accurately recorded their vote, and those pieces of paper can be counted later. So paper trails have been the big reform in the area. And in fact, many states, I think, you know, quite fortunately have adopted laws that require paper trails. New York is one of them, California, Ohio. But in Ohio, a couple weeks ago, Cuyahoga County, which includes Cleveland, decided to do a study of the paper trails that were produced in the May primary in their county, because actually under Ohio law, those paper trails are the official ballots. If there's a discrepancy between what's on the electronic voting machine and what the paper trail says, when you add up all the pieces of paper, it's the paper trail that prevails. So they hired a consultant to look at the paper trails produced in their county in May 2006. Fully 10% of the paper trails were unreadable for one reason or another. Now, that's a terrible thing, because there are, you know, two statewide elections in Ohio, one for the Senate that could potentially determine control of the Senate. They could well be very close on election night. We saw what happened in Florida in 2000. You can just imagine all the lawyers that would descend on Ohio and say, let's look at those paper trails, and it turns out 10% of them, quite possibly more than the margin of victory for one candidate or the other, not readable. So these are terrible problems. Fortunately, we have a great panel here tonight who I'm sure will be able to solve all of them. And I hope to be educated myself. I guess working from Mr. Ravitz, who's closest to me, let me introduce John Ravitz. And we're very fortunate to have him here, because unlike most of us who just sort of hold forth on this issue, John Ravitz is the executive director of the New York City Board of Elections, so he can actually make a lot of this stuff happen. He's where the rubber hits the road on this issue. Many of you may know John, may remember him as an assemblyman from across the park. He represented an East Side Manhattan district from 1991 to 2002. In that capacity, he rose to become assistant minority leader in Albany and assistant minority whip. After that distinguished career in the legislature, John put on his current hat in 2003 and took over the New York City Board of Elections. He's the chief executive officer responsible for overseeing all operations in all five boroughs, 350 full-time employees. He's responsible for preparing the board's annual $80 million operating budget, and he coordinates the board's transition for new citywide voting machines to be in compliance with the federal Help America to Vote Act. John's at a very busy moment right now because, as I mentioned, we don't yet have new voting machines in New York, but we're required by law to have them very soon. So maybe John can tell us where it's all headed.
Thanks. Thank you very much, Adam, and thank you, all the organizations, for putting on this event tonight. And I think it is an important event as we move forward in what is really going to be a sea change for how we as election officials put on elections for you, the voters of the city of New York. And what I have handed out, and I'm sure we did not bring enough copies, but we have a book that I'm going to refer to. We're not going to go through the entire book, so don't panic. We're just going to go through some select pages because I think it's important for everyone to see the work that we are going to have to do at the New York City Board of Elections over the next 6 weeks. And that's really what we're talking about. 6 weeks to make a selection of a new voting system for the entire city. And it should be noted that really right now, this over the last few months, the board has been working really on a three-track track. The first track is that obviously we have had to put on the September 12th primary and get ready for the November 7th general election. In the midst of doing that, the Department of Justice sued New York State for not being in compliance with HAVA and had all of the counties, including the city of New York, select a ballot marking device that would be available for people with disabilities to be able to use. So we had to select a ballot marking device. We had to learn about the software. We had to create the ballots for this new device. We had to train poll workers that we were going to be and staff who were going to be a part of that process, and then really try to reach out to the voters. And we did that in September, and we're going to be doing that again in the general election. And then while we're doing all of that, get ready to select the final voting system for the entire city of the city of New York by the end of December. Let me just refer you, for those of you who are here who have the booklets, and for those of you who don't have books, if you call our phone bank tomorrow, which is 866-VOTE-NYC, we will get you a copy of that as well. But if you go to page 3, I think it's important that everyone understand the voting systems that we are going to be choosing from. There are two types of voting systems. There is the poll site-based optical scanner, which I'm sure will be discussed today, in which a voter would be given a ballot, and instead of going into a voting booth, they would be going into a privacy booth. And they would be marking their ballot, and then they would be scanning that ballot themselves into the poll site optical scanner. And then there are the two different types of DRE systems. There is the ballot overlay DRE, and really the best way to describe the ballot DRE ballot overlay DRE is to think of one of our shoot machines right now of a ballot just plastered on top of that, and instead of pulling a lever as you would with the shoot machine, you'd be actually pushing a button and a light would go off next to your selection. And then the final one is the electronic display DRE, which is the best way to describe it is the ATM style DRE system, similar to the screen that we are using now with the ballot marking devices. Again, the ballot marking devices that we are going to be using for the general election are not voting machines. They do not count votes, but they do assist voters who have various types of disabilities to be able to mark their ballot independently and privately by either using the touch screen, by listening to the ballot, or using a sip and puff type device or rocker paddles. If the New York City Board of Election chooses optical scanners, oh, they're telling me I only have 2 minutes. This is okay. We'll have to move quickly. Okay. Okay, I will refer. Okay. Page 5. I'm sorry. Page 5. Okay. The next. All right. Let me get to important dates that we are going to be looking at because I think that's important. And those dates are on page 17 of the book. That is page 17 of the book. The New York City Board of Election has sent out the RFIs, the request for information, to those vendors who are applying for certification by the State Board. Again, it's important to note that the State Board of Election will be certifying those voting systems, both OpScan and DREs, that they feel meet the HAVA requirements. We have sent out those RFIs. It was a 200-question RFI in which we spent a great amount of time and detail dealing with everything from security and testing to the vendor's history, and then a real section on volume, because we thought it was very important that any vendor who is going to apply for to be the system for New York City understand that we're talking about a system that's going to have to service 4.2 million voters, be at 1,369 poll sites. And so that information has come to us. We are going to be putting that RFI on our website, as well as the answers to that RFI. On We also are developing the selection plan that the evaluation team for the board will be using as they make their recommendations to the commissioners. The commissioners of the City of New York will be making the final selection of the voting system. But again, it is going to be the evaluation team who is going to put forth their recommendations. The evaluation team meetings will be open to the public so that people can see how they are working. But let me give you three dates that are going to be happening in the next 2 weeks that are very important for those of you who are interested in this. On Wednesday, November 15th, at LaGuardia Community College at 5 p.m., we will be having a public demonstration of all of the vendors who are applying for the New York City voting machine systems, both OpScan and DRE. It will give an opportunity for the vendors to do a presentation and then for the commissioners and staff and the public to ask questions. So again, that is going to be Wednesday, November 15th at 5 p.m. at LaGuardia Community College, 310 Thomas Avenue in Long Island City. On Friday, November 17th, at Hostos Community College in the Bronx at 120 Walton Avenue, we will have the same vendors doing the same presentation and being available to answer questions again from the staff. We are going to pick the vendors' names out of a hat. No one is going to be able to be given any special preference. Everyone is going to be treated on the same level playing field. On Tuesday, they're telling me time. Can I give two more dates on this presentation? Because I think that's what people would want to hear. On Tuesday, November 21st, we will be having a public hearing at 42 Broadway at the Commissioner's Hearing Room on the 6th floor at 4 p.m., in which any member of the public will be invited, whether they attended the two presentations the week before or just had issues that they wanted the commissioners to hear about their concerns issues on the new voting systems that we are going to be selecting from. So that will be on November 21st at 4 p.m. at 42 Broadway. I'm not going to dominate the time, but there is a lot of other information that I hope people will ask questions on how we are going to move this process along. And I can discuss that as well. But please, everyone should know this, and it's very important that I feel like sometimes Johnny One Note when I talk about this. The Board of Elections has a job to do, and our job is to facilitate and put on the best elections that we can for the voters of the City of New York. There's a saying that Pam Perkins taught me, our administrative manager who's here, my first day on the job, which is there's not a Democratic way or a Republican way to put on election. There's only the right way to put on an election. And that is what our tenor has been, and that is what our mandate is going to be. And as we move through these very chaotic 6 weeks to make this final selection, that is always going to be the thing that we are going to look at as our number one objective and goal. Whichever system the commissioners select, it will be a system that we believe is the best system for the voters of the City of New York. Thank you.
Thank you, John. I'm sure you will be getting questions when we get to the Q&A period, which we're trying to move to pretty rapidly. As you no doubt have noticed, Congressman Nadler has joined us. I feel like it's not worth wasting much time with this audience introducing Jerry Nadler. You no doubt know him. I grew up on the Upper West Side. I feel like I was born knowing who Jerry Nadler was. But anyway, he is, of course, the Upper West Side's congressman and also Brooklyn as well, and also has worked on not only civil rights, civil liberties, transportation issues, support for the arts, protecting Social Security in Congress, but he's very concerned, I know, about election issues. And as we all know, it's possible that there will be a change in leadership in the House, and I wonder, I'm sure we all do, if that might create any more favorable environment for federal election reform. Jerry.
Thank you very much. With that introduction, Adam, you're starting to make me feel old.
Sorry.
I was introduced by Eric Schneiderman at a fundraiser a couple of years ago. He said there were three speakers, and the first was a rising star in the Democratic Party, and the second was a rising star in the Democratic Party, and Congressman Nadler, who's a legend. I started feeling old then. Let me say, yeah, there is a real difference. And I don't know why there is this difference. Some people have suspicions, but there is a real partisan difference in the House on one question of elections, and that is on the question of a verified paper trail. Most Democrats and a few Republicans are co-sponsors of Rush Holt's bill. Rush Holt represents the Princeton area in New Jersey, of Rush Holt's bill to require an audit verifiable paper trail for elections. Now, most of the DRE machines that are manufactured, or many of them, do not have paper trails. Most of them can be modified. I saw a figure somewhere that they have $60 per machine to have a paper trail. But that costs money. The problem without a paper, and most of the Republicans, or at least the Republican leadership, has not been interested in doing that. That's why the bill hasn't passed. If the Democrats get control of the House, I would assume we would pass such a bill. Whether the Senate would... whether the Senate would remains to be seen, and who knows what the partisan lineup in the Senate will be, but it will certainly be a major objective of the Democrats in Congress. And I would assume of a lot of Republicans, too, not of the current leadership, but if we get control, there'll be a different Republican leadership in all likelihood. The problem with the DREs is that anyone who studied the history of warfare or of technology knows that there's always an ongoing battle between the offense and the defense. The offense in this case being by someone dishonest who wants to use a virus or introduce a virus into an electronic voting machine that says disregard every third Democratic vote or pad the Democratic vote by 20% and destroy these instructions. The defense being the electronic software designed to prevent that from happening. And just as in military warfare, sometimes the offense is dominant, and then the defense makes some discoveries, then the defense is dominant, then the offense, and so forth. The fact is that's always the case in technology. And whatever technological defense you may have in software, which is all proprietary and secret right now, someone is going to discover a way to beat that and to be able to fool the machine. Eventually, someone will discover a way to defend the machine against that, and then someone will discover another offense, and the technology always is advancing between defense and offense, which means you cannot depend on it. The only defense against that is to have a verifiable physical trail that in case a question is raised, you can look at later. Imagine if you have a fairly close election, and someone says, my God, the polls said Smith was going to win 2-1, in this area, and Jones carried it by 60%. Well, that's what the machine says. But who knows that when you hit Smith's name, whether it recorded Smith or Jones? It's all internally to the electronics. You can't trust it. Now, the Diebold people, who are the largest makers, I think they're the largest makers of these machines, say that their defense is perfect. No defense is ever perfect. And no one knows what tomorrow's technology will bring. And if a bunch of teenagers could succeed as they did a few years ago into hacking into the Pentagon's computers, God knows what somebody else will do. But they always claimed that this was proprietary. They wouldn't let anybody test it. Princeton got a hold of this. Some professors at Princeton got a hold of a couple of Diebold machines recently. And it took them a few hours to figure out how to break it. And from then on, anyone with their knowledge could program the machine to do whatever they want to fix the results in less than a minute. In less than a minute. So that tells you you must have a verifiable paper trail. Now, a verifiable paper trail means that when you vote, and I see the 30-second sign. When you vote and you push Smith's name and the light that lights up next to Smith, you hope that the electrons inside are naming Smith. What the paper trail means is that at the same time a piece of paper is generated that you look at, and you look at the screen and it says Smith, you look at the piece of paper next to it, it says Smith, and when you hit the button to effectuate your vote, it cuts off the piece of paper, drops into an internal ballot box, and those papers are available in case anybody wants to check it later. And that's a physical record that is available and would be the legal record, and that's what in the Holt bill we are trying to guarantee, whether it's an optical scan machine or a DRE machine. Without that, you can never guarantee the legitimacy of an election. You can think, even if everybody thinks everything's okay, you never know. And as Doug Kellner, who just walked in and who's been a great pioneer in this for many years, once said at a convention, he said, the word trust should have no place in election administration. not the trust of the machine or the trust of anything. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry. And before we move on to the next panelist, let me just say that there are index cards out there, and if you have questions, we would encourage you, please, to ask them. There also are ushers in the aisles who can take them or can give you cards and pencils, but we'd love to have questions, and we'll get to them shortly. As you just heard, the very mistrustful Doug Kellner just walked in. Doug is in fact, one of the election legends, to use a word that Jerry did, in New York State. He has served as co-chairman of the New York State Board of Elections since December of 2005. Before that, he served as the Democratic commissioner from Manhattan on the New York City Board of Elections, going back to 1993. He's an experienced election lawyer, having served as co-chairman of the Law Committee of the New York State Democratic Committee from 1982 to 1993. He's also served as chairman of the Election Law Committee of the New York County Lawyers Association. When he was first appointed to the New York City Board, Doug was the very first election official to call for a voter verifiable paper audit trail for electronic voting machines. He has continued to be an outspoken advocate for improving voting processes in New York while insisting on transparency, verifiability, and uniformity in voting procedures. Doug, thanks for coming.
All right, thanks. So thank you very much. My apologies if I end up repeating things that other speakers have dealt with. Unfortunately, I had to do a court appearance in Florida this afternoon, and my plane was 2 hours late coming back. But the key to election administration should be these four overriding principles: that the votes are accurate, that the whole process is transparent, that it's verifiable, and that it's done in a uniform manner so that all the candidates are treated the same way. The Help America Vote Act shows the old model that the path to decline is often paved with good intentions. And Congress certainly meant well when they passed the Help America Vote Act to try to avoid the repeat of the problems in Florida in 2000. Unfortunately, it hasn't worked out that way, that because the process was not sufficiently thought through, or indeed we're, as a nation, learning the nature of the problems of election administration, that the results have been with disastrously administered elections in many jurisdictions throughout the country in 2004, and we'll probably see the same thing again in 2006. But in New York, while everyone derides New York for being last in the country, in many ways we are first because we are last. That we have taken the time to learn from the mistakes of other jurisdictions. And indeed, even if we end up losing the $50 million that Congress appropriated for the replacement of lever voting machines and we have to finance it ourselves, we're still going to be ahead of a lot of other states which already spent their money on new election equipment that is already out of date and is going to have to be replaced or upgraded in the next few years. So the one commitment that seems to be a universal bipartisan commitment in Albany is that we are going to do it once and get it right the first time, no matter how long that really takes us to get it right the first time. So we are not going to risk rushing to comply with federal court orders or to spend the federal money that might be available at the risk of having an election where tens of thousands of voters are going to be disenfranchised because of poor administration of the elections. On the positive side, New York, both on the legislation and in the regulations for new voting machines, really has taken the lead. New York State, along with now a majority of the states in the country, requires that there be a verifiable paper audit trail for any direct recording electronic voting machine. New York has really the second toughest statute in the country requiring the escrow of all software and source code that's used in the voting process. And I might add that New York's statute is so tough that literally no one can comply with it right now. So one of the very difficult decisions that we're going to have to make in the next few months, and I guess, you know, I'm going to have to make, is whether to draw lines to exempt certain parts of software that are not essential to the voting process but still technically part of the voting process from the escrow requirements. I have made it clear, however, that under no circumstances am I going to go along with exempting any software that actually deals with the vote counting process from the requirement that the source code be submitted in escrow. And as I say, today that means that none of the five systems that are being considered for certification would pass certification. That will be an interesting thing to see what happens if, come December, the state board rules that none of the machines qualify for certification, because then we're going to end up going back in front of the federal judge who is going to be trying to enforce the Federal Help America Vote Act and say, well, look, 48 other states went along with software that was not escrowed. Are we going to exempt New York from complying with HAVA just because no vendor is willing to do the source code escrow? It's going to be an interesting issue. On the regulation front, I'm very proud that I think New York has the best regulations in the country. And we got there because so many people have been involved in the process. So far, it has been a transparent process. A lot of good government groups have contributed, including some of the people on the dais today. David Kogelman's committee really made substantial contributions to the drafts of the regulations, as did people from the League of Women Voters and New York Verified Voters. Some of the key things in the New York regulations are we were the first state in the country, and I believe we're still the only state in the country, to currently require all voting systems to comply with the federal standards that were adopted in December 2005. Everybody else is still using the 2002 standards, and that's why they're going to have to replace their equipment, because the 2005 standards will become effective in 2 years, and all of that new equipment that was bought is lacking in one way or another in compliance with the 2005 standards. Second thing, we require that all vendors make full disclosure on a quarterly basis of all political contributions. So at least it'll be out on the table. Third thing is that we're not relying on the Independent Testing Authority alone, CYBER, which is the group that has certified machines in many jurisdictions and then found that those machines had to be decertified when outsiders discovered that the certification process was flawed. And we have brought in our own state consultants, New York State Technical Institute, to basically review CYBER. And I might add, on their first review, they found almost 200 deficiencies in CYBER's security tests. And again, that may become an issue, delaying certification, because CYBER is now saying that it may be February or March before they can finish those tests. So I see that my time is up. There are many other things in the regulations that we've added that are unique to New York, but I think are entirely reasonable and are putting us in a position of leading the nation in addressing all of the problems with new voting machines.
Thank you, Doug. Our next panelist, David Kogelman, is an arbitrator and attorney in private practice who's worked for several years to assure that all voting machines have a permanent voter verifiable paper trail and that they can be counted, that the votes on them can be counted accurately, a theme that's emerging tonight. During the 2004 election, David worked to protect people's right to vote in Florida with the Democratic Party and election protection. He's a member of the steering committee of the New York Democratic Lawyers Council and chairman of its HAVA committee, or Help America to Vote Act committee, chairman of the Judiciary Issues Committee for
of Democracy for New York City and a member of the board of Three Parks Independent Democrats. His recent activities have included assembling and working with a volunteer team of lawyers and computer experts to draft standards that voting machines must meet in order to be used in New York State. And Doug has already said the standards were very helpful. So, David.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here today. As a HAVA committee chair for the New York Democratic Lawyers Council, which is made up of attorneys and others who were tried by fire in the fields of Florida and Ohio in 2004 and have formed an organization dedicated to making sure that everybody who has the right to vote gets to vote without hindrance, easily, and that elections are open, transparent, and reliable. as the committee chair, it's been my great honor to work with Doug Kellner and many lawyers on the committee and computer experts in drafting the regulations that govern the certification of voting machines in New York State. The New York State legislature, in its great dysfunctionality, had the choice before it a year and a half ago as to whether to choose one voting system or another. And there was a split in the two branches of the legislature, one of which wanted paper ballot optical scan systems, the other of which, controlled by Republicans, wanted, the first one was controlled by the Democrats, the other which wanted computerized voting systems, DREs. So what we ended up with was a uncomfortable compromise that has created an interesting situation within the state, both in the State Board of Elections and in the local boards of elections, which is that the State Board of Elections will decide, it will examine the machines and decide which ones meet the testing standards, and then the county's election commissioners will get to decide what machines to purchase, whether it be paper ballot optical scan, DREs, or a combination of both. Excuse me. So what happens, and as Congressman Nadler mentioned, this become a partisan issue, and I don't really understand why it's a partisan issue, because free and fair elections are what this country is all about. It's what democracy is based on. But there's become a partisan issue and split between paper ballot optical scan and DREs. An inherently voter verified system, people mark the ballot, or there's a ballot marker for those who have access issues, whether it be language, physical, or whatever, and an electronic system that produces no record except its own. Why this has become a partisan issue is frankly beyond me, but it has. And so we're confronted with a situation where in much of the state there's a potential for conflict within the counties. And the election commissioners have to decide. You've got one Democratic election commissioner, one Republican election commissioner in each county, and they're going to have to decide which machines are purchased for that county. And if they can't agree, the State Board of Elections is going to have to come to agreement. And they're working on a protocol for doing that, but it's going to be a difficult situation. Speaking of the standards that machines have to meet, and the issue of a voter verifiable paper trail. The voter verifiable paper trail is a great issue, a great idea. I fought very hard for it since almost after the passage of the HAVA bill. I lobbied Congress for Rush Holt's bill, and we have much to thank Rush Holt for, because a lot of the best features of his amendment were incorporated in the New York State law, including the requirement for voter verifiable paper trail, requirement that 3% of the votes in every district, in every county, be audited and checked against the machine results, and that there be no wireless communications devices in electronic voting machines. And that's a very fearful one, because with that, anybody remotely could alter the vote results. So the paper trail is a great idea conceptually. In practice, it hasn't really worked out that well. In part, you've heard about Cuyahoga County, where 10% of the paper trail was unreadable. Now, there was testimony just a week or two ago on Rush Holt's bill, which was finally heard in committee, the committee formerly headed by Robert Ney. They got up and they testified about the Cuyahoga problem and said, basically, the paper trail, the printer is a problem, so we should get rid of the printer. Not make a better printer. For the life of me, I've watched this argument develop for the last 3 years, and I do not understand. Machine manufacturers started out by saying, trust us. You know, I hate to quote Ronald Reagan for anything, but when it comes to my vote, trust but verify. Okay, so, but the machine manufacturers came up first to saying, trust us, and resisting the creation of a paper trail. Then they say, you know what, this is great. We can retrofit the machines and we'll make more money. But then they fight retrofitting. Now, I don't understand why businesses would resist making more money. It just doesn't make any sense to me. And, you know, the only thing that occurs to me, you don't have to go into conspiracy theories or anything like this, the only thing that occurs to me is that if there was an audit, and there's never been a full audit of an electronic voting machine, because there's never been a full paper trail audit, the only thing that occurs to me is they don't want an audit because maybe the machines don't work so well. And, in fact, that's what we've seen in many locations where they've been used. And by the way, regarding the situation in Maryland, it was very interesting what happened there because politics somehow or other keeps getting into the issue. One house of the state legislature passed a bill saying, let's get rid of the electronic machines. The governor, the Republican governor, said, yes, let's get rid of the machines. We just spent tens of millions of dollars on it, but we can get rid of them. The other house of the legislature said, we don't want to give the governor anything in an election year, so we're not going to do it. So it behooves all of us to keep involved in the issue, speak to our legislators, and make sure that the county commissioners know what your opinions are on these matters. One last thing. The verified paper trail in New York also has to meet certain environmental requirements that we can reasonably anticipate in New York State, which is that in November, well, you know, there's an election, and upstate it gets pretty cold. So they have to, meet the standards of being able to withstand environmental conditions ranging from 20 degrees below zero to 140 degrees Fahrenheit, which if you were around here in August when it hit 105 or so, you could easily see that in an air-conditioned warehouse. The manufacturers, to my knowledge, up to this date, are only creating paper trails with thermal paper, and I'm not aware of any thermal paper that will stand up to that. So keep informed, keep involved, and keep talking to your election commissioners and spreading the word. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Bo Lipari is a name that should be well known to any of you who follow this issue. He's been outspoken in favor of paper trails and on the whole issue of election reform. Bo is a retired software engineer. He developed software for both large and small companies throughout his 20-year career. In 2003, he became concerned about the rush to use touchscreen electronic voting machines in our elections and began traveling, speaking, and organizing all around New York State, alerting people to the problems with electronic voting. In 2004, Bo founded New Yorkers for Verified Voting, a citizens group working for secure, reliable, accessible, and verifiable standards for voting systems and elections. New Yorkers for Verified Voting has led the struggle in New York State for verifiable, audible voting systems. Since 2006, Bo has served as the League of Women Voters of New York State's representative on the New York State Citizens Election Modernization Advisory Committee. Bo?
Thank you. Let me I'll start with a little story back from the early days of the space age. Those of you who are old enough will remember that at the time there's only two countries that were in space. It was the United States and Russia. And it was the middle of the Cold War, so they didn't talk. The United States astronauts, as they first started getting up into orbital flight, discovered that ballpoint pens don't work in zero gravity. You'll know that if you turn your ballpoint pen upside down, it doesn't work. So when they went back down, discovered the problem, and in typical fashion, they spent millions and millions of dollars developing a pen that would work in zero gravity, upside down, backwards, sideways, whatever you want. It cost millions, but they finally did it. Went up into space using their pen. Years later, as the Cold War thawed, one of the first places where that thaw happened was in the space race. America and Russia began collaborating and communicating on their space program. And one of the first questions the Americans asked the Russians was, say, what did you do about that ballpoint pen problem? And the Russians said, well, we used a pencil. We're faced here in New York with a similar choice. You've got two choices on the table. You can get a high-tech, very expensive, unreliable, bound to be replaced soon, touchscreen voting machine, or we've got an option based on hand-marked paper ballots and precinct-based ballot scanners. Those are the two options on the table. We might wind up, as Commissioner Kellner said, keeping our lever machines for another year or two. Maybe the board won't certify them, finish the process. But ultimately, I think if we don't replace those machines this year, we'll be fighting this battle next year, and we'll be fighting it the year after that. Sooner or later, those lever machines will go. And given the two types of systems there, I think the choice is clear. Cost is clearly a factor, but one factor that people aren't thinking about or talking about much is how many machines do we actually need to replace that lever machine with? State Board of Elections is conducting some studies right now that we hope will give us a determining factor. But the important thing that we realize is it's not sufficient to say, oh, I have this 15-hour election day. Maybe it takes a voter 3.5 minutes to vote on a DRE. And if I divide that evenly over that 15-hour day, that means I can have one DRE for every lever machine. New York City Board of Elections issued a report about a month and a half ago stating exactly that. Unfortunately, there's a lot of problems with that. What's the big problem? Peak voting times. People don't come evenly throughout the day to vote. You know that. Here in New York City, the peak voting time is between 7 a.m. and 10 a.m. That's where you get a lot of people coming in. Same thing after at lunchtime, same thing after 5. So what you have to figure out when you're figuring out how many machines you need to buy is, what's the peak time? How many people can we handle on this given machine at those peak times? Why? Because we need to avoid long lines. If New York State or New York City purchases one DRE for each lever machine, I guarantee you we are going to see 80 to 85%, maybe even 90% of polling places in New York City with long lines at the peak times. What do I mean by long? 2 hours, maybe 3 hours. My group, NYBV, New Yorkers for Verified Voting, is about to release a study doing some computer simulations of this that we believe will demonstrate this. But when you're talking about costs with your commissioners, when you're talking about it with your legislators, let them know that you want to really know what the replacement cost is going to be, not just one-to-one, but when we have to really buy two DREs or three DREs for each lever machine. Better use a paper ballot system. One of the problems with the costing on the handout that you got here, it lowballs the price of the DRE a little bit, but one of the problems is it assumes a one-to-one replacement ratio. I guarantee you if the state study is done right, if we take a look at the computer simulations we're going to release next week, we're going to see that one-to-one will never cut it. It's going to be two-to-one or three-to-one. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is going to make the cost of purchasing touchscreen voting machines untenable for New York State as a whole. Let me finish up real quickly about something Commissioner Kellner said about the process here in New York State. And I do want to note that here in New York State, we are struggling for an open process. Commissioner Kellner, I will say, we don't agree on everything and we butt heads on things, but he certainly has been leading the battle within the State Board of Elections for openness and transparency. But there's a whole system that still does not really want to be open and does not really want to be transparent and does not really want us to have the access that the public needs. We have an escrow requirement to put software in escrow. Well, that's good, but if nobody ever gets to look at that software in escrow, we have no idea if it works. We have no idea if the software that's in escrow is the software that is actually being used on Election Day. And we're going to have, we the public are going to have to hold the State Board of Elections feet to the fire about gaining access to this code for qualified individuals. Myself, as a member of the HAVA Advisory Committee, 12-member committee, I was told I could have access to the source code and the technical data that the vendors had submitted. I even signed a non-disclosure agreement and an oath of office, but guess what? To date, I have yet to see a single piece of technical data. And you know what the answer was when Lee Daglian, the press secretary for the State Board of Elections, said, he said, we can't do that. It might violate the privacy of the vendors. Ladies and gentlemen, this is about the public's right to know, not about the vendor's right to know.
Thank you, Bo. Our final panelist, and then we'll get to questions, is Mark Crispin Miller, a professor, author, and activist. Mark's a professor of culture and communications at New York University. He's written for mainstream media about film, television, politics, advertising, and propaganda. He's appeared on Bill Moyers, The Public Mind, two Frontline documentaries, several feature films. And he's edited a special series published by The Nation and has frequently appeared on national television and NPR. Mark is the author of several books, and he's also, particularly in the last year or so, become a very outspoken voice about election reform and has traveled around the country talking about it. He's also the author of an e-newsletter, News from the Underground. Mark?
Thank you. I'm just going to pick up right where Bo left off. This is not really a technical issue. We're discussing it as a technical issue. It's really not a technical issue. It's a civic issue, okay? It is fundamentally a civic issue. Now, I have my concerns about both optical scanners and paper trails. The fact is that the private vendors that make almost all of this machinery are very close to one of the two political parties. If they were close to the other political party, I would be just as uneasy, because I'm from Chicago. Okay? No offense to you, Jerry. The fact is, if the framers were here today, they would be appalled at the hash that the two parties have made of the election system, which should be completely nonpartisan and completely apolitical. It should be modeled on something like the post office, because this is about us. This is about our rights. And it's, well, okay. I understand.
Federal Express, maybe.
Okay, well, better the post office than the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives, okay? Okay. Don't take that laughter off my time, okay? Okay. Now, it's a civic issue. Now let's look into this, as deeply as we can in 4.5 minutes. As Adam said, some 80% of the electorate will be either casting its votes on electronic voting machines or will have its votes counted by these machines. What we tend not to know is that in state after state after state, this situation came to be despite spirited and well-organized grassroots opposition in California, Illinois, Arizona, Maryland, New Hampshire, Ohio, Florida. There were people who really played by the rules, organized. These efforts were bipartisan, and yet they all came crashing into a brick wall and found, well, what do you know? We're going to have these machines. In any case, that's a civic problem. Add to that high percentage of votes that will essentially be counted in secret, because the use of computers to count votes is kind of like a secret ballot. I mean, you can't, certainly with paperless machines, you can't watch any paper be counted because there's no paper, you know. But even with an optical scanner, you kind of have to take the machine's word for it. Add to that high percentage of votes that are going to be counted in this way, cast or counted in this way, the fact that a number of laws have been passed over the last year in Ohio, in Florida, in California, laws whose clear purpose is to disenfranchise the citizens. In Ohio, HB 50 was passed last summer. This quadruples the price of recounts. It makes audits of machines near impossible. It put severe limitations on registration drives. I mean, I could go on. But, you know, you add these laws to that 80% of the vote that's going to be counted in this secretive way, you got a recipe for disaster. I think that what we need to do, I'm going to second what several of my fellow panelists have said, we need to discuss this issue. We need to get involved in it. We can't just be talking about it at the occasional event like this. It should be covered by the press on a daily basis. The things that I've told you, and I could tell you many more if they weren't for the time constraints, we should all know. It should be common knowledge because this is the most important issue that faces us in a democracy, the most important issue. Because if we don't have the right and the power to choose our representatives, then we have no power of any kind on any front. Now, accuse me of conspiracy theorizing or whatever you like. I think my scholarly credentials are impeccable. But just as a citizen reading the news, I can unfortunately assure you that the election will probably be stolen next month, which is why the president and Roe are telling us, you heard it here first, they're even giving us the number of seats they'll win. I think that in any democracy, the will of the electorate should prevail, okay? Nonpartisan, I'm an independent. I believe deeply in this fact. I believe deeply in the right of the people to choose their representatives, and I think without it, we don't have a democracy. This is a profound... This is a profoundly important civic issue. It is directly connected to things like the Military Commissions Act of 2006. We're dealing with a regime that is profoundly hostile to American democracy. Profoundly hostile, okay? So, reread the Declaration of Independence, you know? Reread Jefferson. The price of freedom is eternal vigilance. This means we have to be involved in all of this. We have to be involved in a whole national discussion of what kind of voting system we're going to use. And if we can't leave it up to the parties and we can't leave it up to the media. We have to have this conversation so that the movement for election reform has to make itself irrelevant by having its understanding and its concerns pass on to the general public. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. We're ready for questions, and we have a bunch already. And if you have more, please... add them to our pile. One I'd like to start with is this one. Do we know the names of the CEOs and board members of the voting system vendors to which candidates and parties they have contributed and how much they gave? And I think one of the things that probably prompts this question is the electronic voting reform movement really reached a turning point in the fall of 2003 when it was divulged that Wally O'Dell, the CEO of Diebold, had actually written a letter, a fundraising letter for Bush Cheney, in which he said he was committed to delivering Ohio for Bush Cheney, and at the same time, Diebold machines were being used to record the votes in Ohio. Since then, Diebold has made a commitment, which they've generally but not always followed, that they that their top executives and staff would not contribute to campaigns. But I guess I'd like to throw this to our two state people, Doug and John. Do we know here in New York State the bona fides of the people who are trying to sell us voting machines?
Adam, as I said, the New York State regulations require those disclosures, and they are posted on the State Board of Elections website.
Now, for those of you concerned about national issues like the presidency and control of Congress, I have to tell you that is not the rule in every state, but it is the rule here. Jerry, do you know if this might be something Congress would look at?
Well, we certainly should look at it, and if the Democrats in control, I imagine we would. But I have to say one thing, and that is that, frankly, I am less interested in who the manufacturer of the voting machine
contributes to or favors, and that will change from time to time, because the fact is that shouldn't matter. The machines, the process should be transparent enough so that whoever, so you know who voted for whom and who made the machine shouldn't matter. The process should be transparent enough. You shouldn't have to trust the guy who made the machine.
That's a good point. Another question, this one is probably mainly for John. Is there any way we can keep our lever machines? How would disabled voters be accommodated?
I've become very paternal to the lever machines, and we are not going to give them up right away. We are going to have to find space for them. Obviously, if this process moves forward, we are not going to just make them scrap metal as some other counties have done. In fact, 2 years ago, Commissioner Kellner will remember this, we had to go out to the state of Georgia and find 800 additional chute machines so that we could meet our requirements. So we'll hold on to the chute machines. In terms of people with disabilities, again, for this November 7th general election, there is going to be an opportunity to use the ballot marking devices. And the ballot marking devices do enable people with disabilities to mark their ballot privately and independently by either using the audio component of the ballot, and in the audio component of the ballot, we have the ballots translated in English, Spanish. In those areas under the Justice Voting Rights Act, we have them in Chinese, in both Mandarin and Cantonese, as well as in Korean. Or they will be able to use a sip and puff device if they need to do that, or the rocker paddles. So those devices will be there. One important distinction, though, if the commissioners of the city board choose OpScan, we are going to have those similar type of ballot marking devices at each of our poll sites, because none of the OpScan devices have the audio component or the sip and puff or the rocker paddles. So if we go OpScan route, you'll also see those type of BMDs, ballot marking devices, at your poll sites as well. And just since I have the microphone, I just want to make one clarification in Bo's comments. In the report that the board did on voters per machine, and we are anxiously awaiting the state board's final determination, we were very clear that there would be an opportunity for poll site configurations that would not just make us have it one DRE per ED or one OpScan per ED. With the technology in both DREs and OpScan, you are going to be able to put multiple EDs on those systems. And that's going to be some of the strategies that as we move forward in all 1,369 of our poll sites, we're going to have to adopt.
Here's a question I'd like to throw to Bo and David, and then anyone else who wants to comment. How are the intended paper ballots stored and handled, and what is to prevent them from being mishandled, lost, or otherwise tampered with?
The answer to that is proper procedures. Here in New York State, we're understandably a little bit in the dark about how you manage paper ballots correctly, because we've been handling lever machines for generations. Other than absentee and affidavit ballots, we don't generally have experience with a lot of paper handling. What New York is going to have to do when we adopt a paper ballot system is develop a robust set of ballot handling procedures. And there are many existing models out there. Almost half the country is voting on paper ballot and scanner systems. Have been doing so for 20 years. So there is a set of best practices out there that keep the ballots watched, keep them audited. That's what we're going to have to look at to manage that. That's one of the big pushbacks. People say, oh, my God, I'll get litigation for the paper ballots. How will I handle them? How do I do that? Other states seem to be managing it just well. And in terms of litigation, well, I tell you what, if we get DREs, I guarantee you we're going to see just as much litigation.
Yeah, and certainly there are lots of options, even if they have not been created yet. For example, optical scanners could be dropping the paper ballots into a locked box of some sort that is then transmitted. As it is right now, when we have emergency ballots on election day, they go into a pouch that's turned over to the police officer at the polling station. But as Bo says, it's a matter of putting in proper procedures, handling procedures, chain of custody procedures, so that the bags don't get taken home at night by the election worker, especially outside the city, you know, because they're tired. It's 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock. They don't want to first drive a half hour to the Board of Elections with the ballots. But there's got to be proper procedures in place and chain of custody procedures in place. And certainly, you know, if the banks can do it all the time, with no reason we can't do it with our vote.
Thanks, David. I'm going to set up a little cliffhanger here. We have another great paranoid, semi-paranoid question of the kind that I enjoy the most. But before we get to it, Joan Palo has a couple of quick announcements, then we'll get back to some questions. Is Joan here? Here she is.
We'll just take a moment. Hello. We'll just take a moment to recognize some of the notable people here. The Chief of Staff of the New York City Board of Elections, Pamela Green Perkins. The Democratic Commissioner for Manhattan Board of Elections, Gregory Sumas. The new Democratic State Committee member from the 67th Assembly District, Arthur Gregg, right down there. Assembly member Linda Rosenthal from the 67th Assembly District was here a little earlier. And I just want to say that in this audience, we see so many people, the grassroots, and each one of you who's responsible for getting the vote out and having to convince people that their vote will count and that they must vote. They can't sit home. In the audience, we have community board members. We have election day coordinators. We have election inspectors, poll site coordinators, super coordinators, and those people we call in the middle of the night crying and cursing and asking for free legal advice, some election lawyers. Each one of you in this audience is very important. Everyone's listening to this very clearly presented information, and all of us have a to-do list when we leave, which is to convince people to know about this and to vote no matter what. The more people who vote, the more we're assured that our votes will count eventually. Thank you. I also want to mention the co-sponsors who weren't mentioned at the beginning of the meeting. The Ansonia Independent Democrats and their district leader, Phyllis Gunther, is here. The Broadway Democrats from a little further uptown, the Park River Independent Democrats, the Three Parks Independent Democrats and their president, Teresa Cantor, the Vincent E. Albano Republican Club, and Democratic District Leader, Mark Landis. Thank you.
Thank you, Joan. So here's our next slightly paranoid question, which I like very much. How will we know that the software placed in escrow is the same software actually installed in the machines? Bo, do you want to take that?
Well, the way to do it is really, this is one of the big unanswered questions so far, but the way in theory that you do it is what's called chain of custody. Chain of custody means from the time that software is compiled in the golden version in the factory and installed on the machine up through the time that machine is delivered, inspected, acceptance tested, up through election day, you need to have specific procedures that can guarantee that that machine has not been tampered with, that you do something called checksumming that can show that one piece of compiled code is identical to another. So chain of custody is the way to do it. However, this is an extremely difficult problem to do well. And one of the challenges moving forward in the next few years for all the states is how are we going to develop chain of custody procedures that can actually guarantee that very important fact.
But it also shows the reason why paper is so important, because if you have paper trails that are counted and if the law requires an audit of a certain percentage of paper ballots by hand, that way it almost doesn't matter what the software says because you're really using paper ballots.
You can at least always have that fallback to go to the paper. That's right.
Right.
You know, let me just interject. Correct me if I'm wrong about this, Bo, but if open source code is being used, namely source code that anybody can examine, and then it doesn't really have to be, well, it has to be placed in escrow, and it's easily checkable at any time by anybody.
It's still not quite that easy. The problem is what you have in escrow, the source code, is in a human-readable form. What's running on the machine is what engineers call compiled. It's in binary form. It's difficult, and without the proper procedures, software companies have procedures like this, to know that that human-readable form of the source code has actually produced that binary code running on the machine.
You know, the truth is also that whatever the software says, at the last minute, a vendor can put on a patch, as happened in Georgia in 2002. What happens if the election is 2 weeks away and the machines aren't working, they send out technicians with new code to try to make it work. That code often does not get certified the way it should. That's what happened in Georgia. And no one really does anything about it. The election officials are embarrassed by the whole situation. So, again, that's why I think paper is really the answer, because that is not susceptible to all of the chicanery that software is.
Can I just jump in for a second?
Please.
This is going to sound like a very radical suggestion, but you know, I certainly agree with you about the superiority of paper. Dennis Kucinich has just submitted a bill to the House calling for the use of paper ballots, which will all be hand-counted. It sounds utopian, doesn't it? It's H.R. 6200. And let's bear in mind that Canada, France, Germany, a lot of democracies do their elections this way, and they manage to get the votes counted very quickly and to everyone's satisfaction. Right, that's true. That's true. One contest, but important enough, an important contest.
Well, and you know, there was a Caltech-MIT study in 2002, I believe it was, that showed that the single most reliable form of voting and vote counting was paper ballots, hand-counted. The next most reliable was paper ballot optical scan systems. Next to the least, after the hanging chads, was the DRE systems. It may have changed slightly since then, but I'm not aware of any study showing that.
Mark, we should mention that the full Luddite program is paper ballots counted by hand and then dipping your thumb in ink like they do in India and Iraq, which we also might favor. Yeah. Make sure you only vote once.
No, absolutely.
Here's a New York-specific question about one of our favorite features of New York law, the full-face ballot. The full-face ballot will make every voting system difficult to use. Isn't it time to get the state legislature to eliminate this requirement? And for those of you who are not election jocks, in New York State, we're required to have every name visible on what's called a full-face ballot at the same time. No turning of pages, nothing like that. Legislators are notorious for not wanting to change this because they want to make sure that their name is on the first page of any possible ballot. No, Jerry's going to defend. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, it's more than that. I'm not an expert on that either, but I do remember reading that in Florida, in some counties in 2000, they had a multi-page system. And the idea of a multi-page system is on facing page one and page one, are all the candidates for president. Turn the page two, all the candidates for U.S. Senate. Page three, all the candidates for local sheriff. Page four, the candidates for dog catcher, and so forth. But in some counties in Florida, there were so many minor party candidates for president that the presidential candidates were on page one and page two. And the instructions said, be sure to vote on every page. So on page one, they voted for Bush or for Gore. And page two, they voted for the communist or the vegetarian, and they lost their votes. Tens of thousands of people lost their votes because of that mistake. And that's a caution about a multi-page system. And the other thing about a multi-page system is you can forget to vote for whatever because you forget you skip that page.
It also actually takes a lot longer also on the DREs. In Florida, it was taking anywhere from 8 to 15 minutes for each voter to vote with the multi-page system.
Anyone agree with the questioner that that full-face ballot makes it more difficult to have a workable electronic machine?
The Brennan Center study recently released shows that full-face DREs show the highest rate of lost votes of any voting technology. Lost votes are sort of undervotes plus. And given that we only have those two choices here, that sort of makes it clear. I don't know that there's will in the legislature to change the full-face ballot. I think most citizens support that idea. I don't know that the politicians in Albany do.
Just on a practical note, I think the other thing that people have to realize, at least for New York City, is how complex and how crowded that ballot is. Because not only do we have to have every candidate's name in English and Spanish, but in certain areas we have to have it in Chinese and Korean. And if you go to the 22nd Assembly District in Queens, you see how tight that ballot is. So even when we move, if we do move to paper, it is not going to be it is going to be a ballot with a lot of information placed on that we are going to have to make sure that the voters understand how to navigate that ballot.
I'd like to direct this to Mark, though anyone else is welcome to jump in. How can ordinary citizens ensure that good election regulations are rigorously followed?
How can
ordinary citizens ensure that good election regulations are rigorously followed?
Well, that's extremely difficult to do in the present circumstances because the system is kept at such a distance from us. I mean, in order for citizens to be able to do that, we'd have to have something tantamount to a revolution, it seems to me. We'd really have to absolutely transform the nature of the system. Right now, we're moving in the wrong direction. For example, Ken Blackwell wants to keep the exit pollsters, 100 yards away from the polling place. That may be overturned, but it takes a lot of costly litigation. And there's no saying that even if the press wins that lawsuit, that they won't find their exit pollsters kept at that distance anyway. I mean, the system is a very lawless one right now. In Georgia, for example, they're not going to use, that is to say, the requirement for photo IDs is not on the books, but a lot of Georgians don't know that, because the authorities have allowed it to be known that people are going to have photo IDs with them. So we, you know, again, I think that in order to get to the point where we can really monitor the process as we should be able to monitor it, we have to change the system radically, and get back in touch with the revolutionary heritage of this country, because we've lost touch with it.
I'll also add, as a reporter, I reported a lot in 2004 on the mechanics of elections, and I've never seen an area with less transparency. I went down to Palm Beach County before their primary in 2004, and people were coming out of the voting place saying that the electronic voting machine wasn't recording votes properly, and I tried to go in there and look, and they literally called the police. It's really not something they want anyone looking over their shoulder on. That said, we're often gloomy about all these issues, but this, you know, election reform is actually one of the few issues in the last few years where grassroots movements have really made a huge difference. We mentioned a lot of states, including New York, Ohio, California, have adopted paper trail rules. That's been a grassroots movement. That's been people like you educating state legislators and getting them to care about it, and it's worked. So I would say this is one issue don't be discouraged on. If you follow it closely, if you call your legislators, if you tell them it matters, it really does make a difference.
Oh, I've got to jump in here. I mean, this is crucial. I mean, I paint a bleak picture necessarily because I only have 5 minutes. But the thing is, I know it isn't. I just lost the thread of what I was going to say. It was so important, too. Yes, I mean, if you point out the flaws in the system, one can reply, and I think a lot of Democrats have replied, well, you know, that's going to lower turnout. People will think their vote's not going to count. My argument is that you tell people about the possibility of fraud as a way to get them to come out and vote. See, the higher the turnout, the harder it is to spin an illegitimate victory as legitimate. You need a high turnout. It's got to be as high as possible. Rather than keep the frightening facts from people in the hope that they'll just kind of vote, and then we cross our fingers and hope that their choices prevail, we should say, you know, your right to vote is on the line here. You should turn out to vote as a protest. You must turn out to vote. It's crucial. I'm actually not crazy about early voting and absentee ballot voting either. Absentee ballots can be, I mean, historically, they've been the first to be fiddled with. That's not insurance. You throw them away. It's very easy. But the fact is that lowers the election day turnout. We must have a high turnout. That's crucial. So, you know, it may seem gloomy, the picture I paint, but I think it's just the reality. Our democracy is on the line, and we should regard Election Day not just as an opportunity to get out there and choose somebody, but as an opportunity to demonstrate that this is precious to us, this means a lot to us, And we should indeed monitor the, you know, monitor the polls. You can join New Yorkers for Verified Voting here in town. You can give to the Election Defense Alliance, which I'm very close to, which is going to try to organize rapid response teams to go to trouble spots. Because what tends to happen is, before Election Day, we know there's going to be trouble. And then Election Day comes, and we're all amnesiacs. We think, oh, well, the people have spoken. We have to remember this conversation, these concerns, and make sure that the results are really legitimate and we can be confident that they are.
Let me just say that's part of the function of the New York Democratic Lawyers Council as well. We are actually a project of the State Democratic Committee and the DNC, and we're going to be out there with lawyers trained to do election voter protection throughout the state on Election Day. We're mustering up as many lawyers as we can find to train for that, not because we expect anything to go wrong, but so that people's right to vote is protected, so that even innocent errors in the voting station, where workers are often ill-prepared for unusual things that occur, may not know the rules that well, they get the right to vote. So there's a lot of organizations who are out there doing that. And just for anybody out there who doesn't think that one person can make much of a difference, I've got to tell you that the man seated to my left is a classic example of how untrue that statement is, how much of a difference one person can make. 3 years ago, optical scan, paper ballot and optical scan systems were not on the radar in New York. Thanks to Beau's work, New Yorkers for Verified Voting, and his work, his tireless efforts throughout the state, we now have a choice. Thank you, Beau.
Thank you, David.
I wanted to add that we have 30,000 election workers are required just in New York City alone to run an election. And the single biggest problem, in my view, by a major factor, is not voting machines, but the administration of the elections by our poll workers on Election Day. And that is a very important position. I see that probably about half the people in this room are poll workers. And that's a critical position, so that it's not something where you just have to complain. You can actually be a part of the solution by being a poll worker. And the government has to give much higher commitment to compensating people for doing that 15-hour job and for compensating them for attending training and to insist that everybody be trained. That is a major factor. Another thing I want to point out is that it's important for the public to demand access and transparency at all of the stages of the vote counting process. 3% of the ballots are cast by absentee ballots in New York City, and there is virtually no monitoring of those absentee ballots except for the Republican and Democratic employees of the Board of Elections. It's a relatively easy thing to misplace that paper or to lose it entirely, and so tracking those absentee ballots is very important. Similarly, about 3% of the votes in New York are on affidavit ballots, and there is a wide margin between the number of affidavit ballots that are approved in each of the counties because of varying procedures and the level of oversight on the election workers who are doing that. And so, again, if the public demands access to that process, that can significantly increase the reliability of election results.
If I could just add on the poll worker issue, because I think Commissioner Kellner has really touched on one of the things that we are going to have to be focusing on. In my remarks earlier, I said it's going to be a huge sea change for voting in New York, and clearly the 30,000 poll workers are going to be instrumental in facilitating that sea change. Our three-hour class is going to have to be scrapped. We have already alerted the city, both the Office of Management and Budget, who's going to have to fund us, and the mayor and the city council, that we are looking now in an all-day class. Because the poll workers are going to have to learn the new system, whichever system that is. There are going to be new poll site procedures from A to Z that are going to have to be learned. We're going to add a section of the curriculum on being issues of sensitivity for voters with disabilities, as well as language assistance issues that we have here in New York City. So we have already made the request for the city that they are going to have to pay more for than $200 a day for a poll worker or $300 a day for a coordinator, as well as the money that we pay for somebody who takes the class and passes the test. So we are going to continue to fight for that, and I urge all of you to write to your city council members and write to the mayor on that as well. And in terms of, again, the public being aware of what's going on, the two dates that I gave you earlier are dates that I hope we will hear and see people from. We are going to have all the vendors that are applying for certification demonstrating their systems and taking questions, not just from the commissioners and staff, but from the public. And again, those dates are November 15th at LaGuardia Community College, and these will be posted on our website at 5 p.m. and on November 17th at Hostos Community College.
Let me also put in a plug for election protection. I'm not sure if you're familiar with this concept, but I was in Cleveland, Ohio on Election Day 2004 as a reporter at the biggest African-American voting precinct in East Cleveland, and it was a very tense environment. The night before, there had been reports that there were going to be monitors challenging every voter at every precinct in certain parts of the state. When I got there, there were a lot of voters, first-time voters straggling in, who some of whom said, you know, I registered on a street corner, I registered on a bus. There were also a group of people from election protection programs who were there to make sure that those people were able to vote. And they went in with them, and they showed them what to do, and they argued for them. And it was really kind of inspiring to see the voters come out and talk about how important a role that advocate had played. So if you're really interested in getting involved in a grassroots level, you know, find a contested area and volunteer to do election protection, I think you'll find it's a fascinating and rewarding experience. Here's a question for electronic voting wonks like some of us up here about optical scanners, which a lot of people believe are actually the best system of all the imperfect systems there are. What are the safeguards in the optical scanners? Who else makes optical scanners besides big electronic voting companies? And I guess the gist of it, though, is why do people like electronic? Why do people like optical scanners better than DRE machines?
I think the reason people like optical scanners better than DRE machines is not so much because of the scanner; it's because of the hand-marked paper ballot. When you're using a DRE, even one with a voter-verified audit trail, we're still depending on the software to produce that audit trail. We know from studies that maybe only a third of the voters are checking that. So with the optical scan system, you've got that original hand-marked ballot. What are the safeguards? Well, with any electronic system, you're going to have, as I mentioned earlier, chain of custody procedures, real independent security reviews of the source code. So in terms of procedures and things, you have similar things, although scanners are ultimately simpler systems and have fewer, less complex software because they do fewer things. They only count. But ultimately, I would like to see New York and around the country, I would like to see us taking back the control of the scanners from these private vendors and making that a function of state government. Oklahoma is an example. Oklahoma uses optical scanners, and they bought their scanners, and they told the vendors, thanks a lot. We'll call you if we need some spare parts. And Oklahoma has taken over maintenance of the software, maintenance of the machines. Ultimately, I want to see not only citizen oversight of elections, I want to see citizen control of elections. I want the vendors out.
Especially in large polling places, how can we be certain there will be enough voting machines to handle a heavy load? John, and then maybe Jerry can talk about this on a national level.
How can we?
Oh, especially in large polling places, how can we be certain there will be enough voting machines to handle a heavy load, a busy day?
Well, again, that is going to be one of the criteria that as the commissioners make their selections and as the evaluation team gathers all the data from the RFI and from the demonstrations and from the public hearing and from the vendor interviews, they will be looking at. Again, one of the key dates, milestones in this entire process, and this process, again, starts now with the RFIs being submitted to the board, and supposedly by December 28th, we in the city are going to make our selection because the Office of General Services in Albany has told all of the counties that they need to have a completed order form by January 5th, 2007. But one of the key milestone dates will be when the State Board of Elections decides what the regulations are going to be for voters per machine. And again, we discussed this earlier this evening, and it's going to be an issue, and it's sometimes insider baseball to talk about it, but again, we are going to have to be able to, if we choose OpScan or DREs, and the number is dropped dramatically from 800 to, say, 400 or 200, we will have to deal with that, and we will have to have multiple machines at the poll sites. That's not going to be an issue. We will have the number of machines that we need in New York City at each of our poll sites. And we have some poll sites that have two machines, and we have the largest poll site in the city, which is Co-op City, which has over 20-plus machines. Each of our 1,369 poll sites will be given the proper machines that they need. We just need to know how many voters per machine we are going to be able to have on those, whatever system the commissioners choose.
Let me just say that on the federal level, I mean, we have a tradition in this country which we're beginning to get away from that that local governments run elections. It's that this is a state function. The HAVA Act is really the first major change in that, where the federal government started setting up standards for local elections. I was on the hearing that John Conyers chaired after the election 2 years ago in Ohio, and it was very clear from what people testified that certain areas deliberately were given many more machines per voter than other areas because of the anticipated results, and certain areas had long lines and others didn't. And I suspect that Congress should set up as a condition of federal help or just as a condition of electing members of Congress, which we have the constitutional ability to do, guidelines for saying how you allocate machines to make sure that equal protection is afforded. And by the way, the Supreme Court decision in Bush v. Gore, even though the court said there shouldn't be a precedent, is a precedent for setting equal protection standards as between counties and within counties as a federal constitutional matter. So we clearly have the power to do that, and I hope we exercise that power.
I think we have time for one last question, and then after that, Joan is going to come up and say a couple of brief words. I hope you'll stay around for that. Since we all believe in transparency, I'm going to give the last question to the one person who signed their name to their question, Tracy Denton. A question for Bo or Mark. What can we do about the fact that when DRE machines are presented to voters, many voters like them and find them easy to use? They are designed to make it seem to the voter that their vote is secure, but there's no guarantee the vote is secure. What can we do about this false perception?
Well, actually, I don't know who these people are who like the machines. I know that boards of elections in different states like them because it makes their jobs easier. But John Zogby did a poll and found that very few Americans really like the DRE machines. I mean, if we're going to be completely small D democratic about it, we wouldn't use them because there's no reason to use them. I mean, there's no reason. I mean, we didn't even, well, Bo talked a little bit about how expensive they are. But there's really no good argument for using them. They are used because the Help America Vote Act requires states to use disabled-friendly systems. And these systems are defined as disabled-friendly. There is an alternative called VotePad, which is a non-computerized disabled-friendly system, with companies now suing the state of California for summarily refusing to consider VotePad instead of Diebold. The fact that I think that here, you know, although maybe a lot of kids would like to vote on the machines because it reminds them of video games, I don't think they're terribly popular. And they're unpopular precisely because you really don't have a sense of certainty and control. You know, understand there were thousands of reports in 11 states of people who claimed they pushed the button for Kerry and the machine flipped the vote over to Bush. 11 states. This just didn't happen in Ohio. I looked as hard as I could. I found 4 examples of machines flipping Bush votes to Kerry. 4. That doesn't, you know, I mean, I think people know enough about computers. They know enough you know, from having lost text and all the other stuff that happens to you, that it's really not a very heartwarming way to govern yourself, you know?
I'll also say, you know, I hear that, but what I look at is what I see when I travel around the state. I do presentations. I do panels like this. I've attended legislative hearings all around New York State. I have yet to hear anybody get up and testify in favor of DREs, except in one exception. Nassau County, about a year and a half ago, they had legislative hearings. Everybody testified in favor of OPSCAN, except for two people. But who were they? They actually were sales reps for the DREs. That was the only people they could get to testify in favor. So I agree with Mark. I don't think people are so enamored, and I think people very quickly see through that veil.
And more the bad news is getting out. I don't know if you saw this, but in the Virginia Senate race, which may be the closest in the country, it turns out that because of a programming error, the Democratic candidate, James Webb, will not get his full name on the ballot.
Right.
This was just reported
right.
in the Washington Post. It's going to be James, Jimmy, and I don't think the W gets there either.
Right.
So I think the more people hear these stories, the more skeptical they become.
Right. And this has been a problem that's existed there that they've known about for 3 years now. The other thing I wanted to add to what Bo said is that I have yet to see a newspaper editorial board endorse DREs rather than OPSCAN machines.
Okay, so let's get Joan up here, and then when she's done, I'm sure that members of the panel will be happy to talk to you individually if you have more questions.
Certainly.
I hope.
Of course, there were people who pointed out to us that they were in the audience and not recognized. Is Botnia Luton still here from the Sierra Club? The Sierra Club is here, and they are a host or a sponsor, full sponsor, and I don't know that we recognize them sufficiently, but they are steadfast and nonpartisan. Deborah Cooper, the state committee woman from the 67th Assembly District. We have a lot to ask of our city council, and of course, the ever-popular Gail Brewer is in the audience, our city council person. And Judy McGowan is here, the state committee woman from the 81st Assembly District, the Ben Franklin Reform Democratic Club. Thank you.
Thank you very much. On behalf of Sally Swisher, my co-chair, the committee who worked on this, we would very much like to thank Mr. Cohen, our panelists, and all of you for coming tonight. Thank you very much.